Lapses of self-control can also cause violence on larger scales. Many stupid wars and riots began when leaders or communities lashed out against some outrage, but come the next morning had reason to regret the outburst. The burning and looting of African-American neighborhoods by their own residents following the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, and Israel's pulverizing of the infrastructure of Lebanon following a raid by Hezbollah in 2006, are just two examples. In this section, I will examine the science of self-control to see if it supports the theory of the civilizing process, in the same way that the preceding section examined the science of empathy to see if it supported the theory of the expanding circle. The theory of the civilizing process, like Freud's theory of the id and the ego from which it was derived, makes a number of strong claims about the human nervous system, which we will examine in turn. Does the brain really contain competing systems for impulse and self-control? Is self-control a single faculty in charge of taming every vice, from overeating to promiscuity, to procrastination, to petty crime, to serious aggression? If so, are there ways for individuals to boost their self-control? And could these adjustments proliferate through a society, changing its character toward greater restraint across the board? Let's begin by trying to make sense of the very idea of self-control and the circumstances in which it is and isn't rational. First, we must set aside pure selfishness, doing something that helps oneself but hurts others, and focus on self-indulgence, doing something that helps oneself in the short term but hurts oneself in the long term. Examples abound. Food today, fat tomorrow. Nicotine today, cancer tomorrow. Dance today, pay the piper tomorrow. Sex today, pregnancy, disease, or jealousy tomorrow. Lash out today, live with the damage tomorrow. There is nothing inherently irrational about preferring pleasure now to pleasure later. After all, the you on Tuesday is no less worthy of a chocolate bar than the you on Wednesday. On the contrary, the you on Tuesday is more worthy. If the chocolate bar is big enough, it might tide you over. So eating it on Tuesday means that neither you is hungry, whereas saving it for Wednesday consigns you to hunger on Tuesday. Also, if you abstain from chocolate on Tuesday, you might die before you wake, in which case neither the Tuesday you nor the Wednesday you gets to enjoy it. Finally, if you put the chocolate away, it might spoil or be stolen, again depriving both yous of the pleasure. All things being equal, it pays to enjoy things now. That is why, when we lend out money, we insist on interest. A dollar tomorrow really is worth less than a dollar today, even if we assume there is no inflation, and interest is the price we put on the difference. Interest is charged at a fixed rate per unit of time, which means that it compounds or increases exponentially. That compensates you exactly for the decreasing value of the money coming back to you as time elapses, because the decrease in value is also exponential. Why exponential? With every passing day, there is a fixed chance you will die, or that the borrower will abscond or go bankrupt, and you'll never see the money again. As the probability that this will not have happened dwindles day by day, the compensation you demand multiplies accordingly. Going back to pleasure, a rational agent, when deciding between indulging today and indulging tomorrow, should indulge tomorrow only if the pleasure would be exponentially greater. In other words, a rational agent ought to discount the future and enjoy some pleasure today at the expense of less pleasure tomorrow. It makes no sense to scrimp all your life so that you can have one hell of a 90th birthday bash. Self-indulgence becomes irrational only when we discount the future too steeply, when we devalue our future selves way below what they should be worth, given the chance that those selves will still be around to enjoy what we've saved for them. There is an optimum rate of discounting the future, mathematically an optimum interest rate, which depends on how long you expect to live, how likely you will get back what you saved, how long you can stretch out the value of a resource, and how much you would enjoy it at different points in your life. For example, when you're vigorous or frail. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, is a completely rational allocation, if we are sure we are going to die tomorrow. What is not rational is to eat and drink as if there's no tomorrow, when there really is a tomorrow. To be overly self-indulgent, to lack self-control, is to devalue our future selves too much, or equivalently, to demand too high an interest rate before we deprive our current selves for the benefit of our future selves. No plausible interest rate would make the pleasure in smoking for a 20-year-old self outweigh the pain of cancer for her 50-year-old self. Much of what looks like a lack of self-control in the modern world may consist of using a discounting rate that was wired into our nervous systems in the iffy world of our pre-state ancestors, when people died much younger and had no institutions that could parlay savings now into returns years later. Economists have noted that when people are left to their own devices, they save far too little for their retirement, as if they expect to die in a few years. That is the basis for the libertarian paternalism of Richard Thaler, Cass Sunstein, and other behavioral economists, in which the government would, with people's consent, tilt the playing field between their current and future selves. One example is setting an optimal retirement savings plan as the default, which employees would have to opt out of, rather than as a selection they would have to opt into. Another is to shift the burden of sales taxes onto the least healthy foods. But weakness of the will is not just a matter of discounting the future too steeply. If we simply devalued our future selves too much, we might make bad choices. But the choices would not change as time passed, and the alternatives drew near. If the inner voice shouting, "Dessert sooner," outvoted the one whispering, "Fat later," it would do so whether the dessert was available for consumption in 5 minutes or in 5 hours. In reality, the preference flips with imminence in time, a phenomenon called myopic discounting. When we fill in the room service card at night and hang it on the hotel doorknob for the following morning's breakfast, we are apt to tick off the fruit plate with non-fat yogurt. If instead we make our choices at the buffet table, we might go for the bacon and croissants. Many experiments on many species have shown that when two rewards are far away, organisms will sensibly pick a large reward that comes later over a small reward that comes sooner. If, for example, you had a choice between $10 in a week and $11 in a week and a day, you'd pick the second. But when the nearer of the two rewards is imminent, self-control fails, the preference flips, and we go for smaller sooner over larger later. $10 today over $11 tomorrow. Unlike merely discounting the future, which makes sense if the discount rate is properly set, myopic discounting, with its reversal of preferences, is not in any obvious way rational. Yet all organisms are myopic. Mathematically minded economists and psychologists explain the myopic preference reversal by saying that organisms engage in hyperbolic discounting rather than the more rational exponential discounting. When we depreciate our future selves instead of repeatedly multiplying the subjective value of a reward by a constant fraction with every unit of time we have to wait for it, rendering it half as valuable, then a quarter, then an eighth, then a sixteenth, and so on, we multiply the original subjective value by a smaller and smaller fraction, which renders it half as valuable, then a third, then a quarter, then a fifth, and so on. This insight can also be expressed in a more intuitive, qualitative way. A hyperbola is a mathematical curve with a bit of an elbow, where a steep slope looks like it has been welded onto a shallow one, unlike an exponential curve, which is a smoother ski jump. That jibes with the psychological theory that myopic discounting arises from a handoff between two systems inside the skull, one for rewards that are imminent, another for rewards that are far in the future or entirely hypothetical. As Thomas Schelling put it, people behave sometimes as if they had two selves, one who wants clean lungs and long life, and another who adores tobacco, or one who wants a lean body and another who wants dessert, or one who yearns to improve himself by reading Adam Smith on self-command, and another who would rather watch an old movie on television. Freud's theory of the id and the ego, and the older idea that our lapses are the handiwork of inner demons, the devil made me do it, are other expressions of the intuition that self-control is a battle of homunculi in the head. The psychologist Walter Mischel, who conducted classic studies of myopic discounting in children, the kids are given the agonizing choice between one marshmallow now and two marshmallows in 15 minutes, proposed with the psychologist Janet Metcalf that the desire for instant gratification comes from a hot system in the brain, whereas the patience to wait comes from a cool system. In previous sections, we have caught glimpses of what the hot and cool systems might be, the limbic system and the frontal lobes. The limbic system includes the rage, fear, and dominance circuits that run from the midbrain through the hypothalamus to the amygdala, together with the dopamine-driven seeking circuit that runs from the midbrain through the hypothalamus to the striatum. Both have two-way connections to the orbital cortex and other parts of the frontal lobes, which, as we saw, can modulate the activity of these emotional circuits, and which can come between them and the control of behavior. Can we explain self-control as a tug-of-war between the limbic system and the frontal lobes? In 2004, the economists David Labson and George Lowenstein teamed up with the psychologist Samuel McClure and the neuroimager Jonathan Cohen to see if the paradox of myopic discounting could be explained as a give-and-take between two brain systems, as they put it, a limbic grasshopper and a frontal lobe ant. Participants lay in a scanner and chose between a small reward, such as $5, which would be available in the nearish future, and a larger reward, such as $40, which would only be available several weeks later. The question was, did the brain treat the choice differently depending on whether it was $5 now versus $40 in 2 weeks, or $5 in 2 weeks versus $40 in 6 weeks? The answer was that it did. Choices that dangled the possibility of immediate gratification in front of a participant lit up the striatum and the medial orbital cortex. All the choices lit up the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the part of the frontal lobes involved in cooler, more cognitive calculations. Even better, the neuroimagers could literally read the participants' minds. When their lateral prefrontal cortex was more active than their limbic regions, the participants held off for the larger, later reward. When the limbic regions were as active or more active, they succumbed to the smaller, sooner one. As we've seen in the front-heavy brain, the frontal lobes are massive structures with many parts, and they carry out self-control of several kinds. The rearmost margin, which abuts the parietal lobe, is called the motor strip, and it controls the muscles. Just in front of it are premotor areas that organize motor commands into more complex programs. These are the regions in which mirror neurons were first discovered. The portion in front of them is called the prefrontal cortex, and it includes the dorsolateral and orbital ventromedial regions we have already encountered many times, together with the frontal pole at the tip of each hemisphere. The frontal pole is sometimes called the frontal lobe of the frontal lobe, and together with the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, it is active when people choose a large late reward over a smaller imminent one. Traditional neurologists, the doctors who treat patients with brain damage rather than sliding undergraduates into scanners, were not surprised by the discovery that it is the frontal lobes that are most involved in self-control. Many unfortunate patients end up in their clinics because they discounted the future too steeply and drove without a seatbelt or bicycled without a helmet. For the small immediate reward of getting on the road a second sooner or feeling the wind in their hair, they gave up a large later reward of walking away from an accident with their frontal lobes intact. It's a bad bargain. Patients with frontal lobe damage are said to be stimulus-driven. Put a comb in front of them and they will immediately pick it up and comb their hair. Put food in front of them and they will put it in their mouths. Let them go into the shower, and they won't come out until they are called. Intact frontal lobes are necessary to liberate behavior from stimulus control, to bring people's actions into the service of their goals and plans. In a collision with a hard surface, the frontal lobe bangs against the front of the skull and is damaged indiscriminately. Phineas Gage's freak accident, which sent a spike cleanly up through his orbital and ventromedial cortex and largely spared the lateral and frontmost parts, tells us that different parts of the frontal lobes implement different kinds of self-control. Gage, recall, was said to have lost the equilibrium between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities. Neuroscientists today agree that the orbital cortex is a major interface between emotion and behavior. Patients with orbital damage, recall, are impulsive, irresponsible, distractible, socially inappropriate, and sometimes violent. The neuroscientist Antonio Damasio attributes this syndrome to the patient's insensitivity to emotional signals. He has shown that when they gamble on cards with different odds of gaining and losing money, they don't show the cold sweat that normal people experience when they bet on a card with ruinous odds. This emotionally driven self-control, what we might call apprehension, is evolutionarily ancient, as shown by the well-developed orbital cortex in mammals such as rats. But there are also cooler, more rule-driven forms of self-control, and they are implemented in the outer and frontmost parts of the frontal lobe, which are among the parts of the brain that expanded the most in the course of human evolution. We have already seen that the dorsolateral cortex is engaged in rational calculation of costs and benefits, as in the choice between two delayed rewards, or in the choice between diverting a runaway trolley onto a sidetrack with a single worker or letting it proceed to the main track with five. The frontal pole sits even higher in the chain of command, and neuroscientists credit it with our suppleness in negotiating the competing demands of life. It is engaged when we multitask, when we explore a new problem, when we recover from an interruption, and when we switch between daydreaming and focusing on the world around us. It is what allows us to branch to a mental subroutine and then pop back up to the main thing we were trying to accomplish, as when we interrupt ourselves while cooking to run to the store to get a missing ingredient and then resume the recipe when we return. The neuroscientist Etienne Kirklin summarizes the functioning of the frontal lobe in the following way. The rearmost portions respond to the stimulus, the lateral frontal cortex responds to the context, and the frontal pole responds to the episode. Concretely, when the phone rings and we pick it up, we are responding to the stimulus. When we are at a friend's house and let it ring, we are responding to the context. And when the friend hops into the shower and asks us to pick up the phone if it rings, we are responding to the episode. Impulsive violence could result from malfunctions in any of these levels of self-control. Take the violent punishment of children. Modern Western parents who have internalized norms against violence might have an automatic, almost visceral aversion to the thought of spanking their children, presumably enforced by the orbital cortex. Parents in earlier times and other subcultures, such as mothers who say, "Wait till your father gets home," might modulate the spanking depending on how serious the infraction is, whether they are at home or in a public space, and if they are at home, whether there are guests in the house. But if they are weak in self-control or are inflamed by what they see as egregious naughtiness, they might lose their tempers, which means that the rage circuit shakes free of frontal lobe control and they thrash the child in a way they might regret later. Adrian Raine, who previously showed that psychopaths and impulsive murderers have a small or unresponsive orbital cortex, recently carried out a neuroimaging experiment that supports the idea that violence arises from an imbalance between impulses from the limbic system and self-control from the frontal lobes. He scanned a sample of wife batterers as they tried to ignore the meanings of printed words for negative emotions such as anger, hate, terror, and fear, and just named the color in which they were printed, a test of attention called the Stroop task. The batterers were slowed down in naming the colors, presumably because their background anger made them hypersensitive to the negative emotions the words spelled out. And compared to the brains of normal people, who can examine the print without getting distracted by the words' meanings, the batterer's limbic structures were more active, including the insula and striatum, while their dorsolateral frontal cortex was less active. We may surmise that in the brains of impulsive assailants, aggressive impulses from the limbic system are stronger and the self-control exerted by the frontal lobes is weaker. Most people, of course, are not so lacking in self-control that they ever lash out in violence. But among the nonviolent majority, some people have more self-control than others. Aside from intelligence, no other trait augurs as well for a healthy and successful life. Walter Mischel began his studies of delay of gratification, in which he gave children the choice between one marshmallow now and two marshmallows later, in the late 1960s, and he followed the children as they grew up. When they were tested a decade later, the ones who had shown greater willpower in the marshmallow test had now turned into adolescents who were better adjusted, attained higher SAT scores, and stayed in school longer. When they were tested 1 and 2 decades after that, the patient children had grown into adults who were less likely to use cocaine, had higher self-esteem, had better relationships, were better at handling stress, had fewer symptoms of borderline personality disorder, obtained higher degrees, and earned more money. Other studies with large samples of adolescents and adults have documented similar payoffs. Adults can wait indefinitely for 2 marshmallows, but as we have seen, they can be given equivalent choices such as, would you rather have $5 now or $40 in 2 weeks? Studies by Labson, Christopher Chabri, Chris Kirby, Angela Duckworth, Martin Seligman, and others have found that people who opt for the latter and larger sums get higher grades, weigh less, smoke less, exercise more, and are more likely to pay off their credit card balance every month. Baumeister and his collaborators measured self-control in a different way. They asked university students to divulge their own powers of self-control by rating sentences such as these. I am good at resisting temptation. I blurt out whatever is on my mind. I never allow myself to lose control. I get carried away by my feelings. I lose my temper too easily. I don't keep secrets very well. I'd be better off if I stopped to think before acting. Pleasure and fun sometimes keep me from getting work done. I am always on time. After adjusting for any tendency just to tick off socially desirable traits, the researchers combined the responses into a single measure of habitual self-control. They found that the students with higher scores got better grades, had fewer eating disorders, drank less, had fewer psychosomatic aches and pains, were less depressed, anxious, phobic, and paranoid, had higher self-esteem, were more conscientious, had better relationships with their families, had more stable friendships, were less likely to have sex they regretted, were less likely to imagine themselves cheating in a monogamous relationship, felt less of a need to vent or let steam off, and felt more guilt but less shame. Self-controllers are better at perspective-taking and are less distressed when responding to others' troubles, though they are neither more nor less sympathetic in their concern for them. And contrary to the conventional wisdom that says that people with too much self-control are uptight, repressed, neurotic, bottled up, wound up, obsessive-compulsive, or fixated at the anal stage of psychosexual development, the team found that the more self-control people have, the better their lives are. The people at the top of the scale were the mentally healthiest. Are people with low self-esteem more likely to perpetrate acts of violence? Circumstantial evidence suggests they are. Recall from Chapter 3, The Theory of Crime, championed by Michael Gottfredson, Travis Hershey, James Q. Wilson, and Richard Herrnstein, in which the people who committed crimes are those with the least self-control. They opt for small, quick, ill-gotten gains over the longer-term fruits of honest toil, among them the reward of not ending up in jail. Violent adolescents and young adults tend to have a history of misconduct at school, and they tend to get into other kinds of trouble that bespeak a lack of self-control, such as drunk driving, drug and alcohol abuse, accidents, poor school performance, risky sex, unemployment, and nonviolent crimes such as burglary, vandalism, and auto theft. Many violent crimes are strikingly impulsive. A man will walk into a convenience store for some cigarettes and on the spur of the moment pull out a gun and rob the cash register. Or he will react to a curse or insult by pulling out a knife and stabbing the insulter. To make the case more than circumstantial, one would have to show that the psychologist's conception of self-control, measured by people's choice between smaller, sooner, and larger, later rewards, or by ratings of their own impulsiveness, match up with the criminologist's conception of self-control, measured by actual outbreaks of violence. Michelle tested children in urban middle schools and in camps for troubled youth and found that the children who waited longer for larger piles of M&Ms were also less likely to get into fights and to pick on their playmates. Many studies of teachers' ratings have confirmed that the children who appear to them to be more impulsive are also the ones who are more aggressive. A particularly informative study by the psychologists Avshalom Kaspi and Terry Moffat followed an entire cohort of children born in the New Zealand city of Dunedin from the year of their birth in 1972 through 73. Three-year-old children who were rated as under-controlled, that is, impulsive, restless, negativistic, distractible, and emotionally fluctuating, grew into 21-year-olds who were far more likely to be convicted of a crime. The study did not distinguish violent from nonviolent crimes, but later studies on the same sample showed that the two kinds of crime tend to go together. And one of the causes of their greater criminality may have been differences in their anticipation of the consequences of their behavior. In their answers to questionnaires, the less controlled people gave lower odds that they would get arrested following a string of crimes and that they would lose the respect of their friends and family if their illegal behavior came to light. The trajectory of crime in adolescence and young adulthood is related to an increase in self-control, measured in a growing willingness to choose larger late rewards over smaller earlier ones. This change is partly driven by the physical maturation of the brain. The wiring of the prefrontal cortex is not complete until the third decade of life, with the lateral and polar regions developing last. But self-control is not the whole story. If delinquency depended only on self-control, young teenagers should become less and less likely to get in trouble as they turn into older teenagers, which is not what happens. The reason is that violence depends not just on self-control, but on the urges that self-control has to control. Adolescence is also an age that sees the rise and fall of a motive called sensation-seeking, driven by activity in the seeking system, which peaks at 18. It also sees an increase in male-against-male competitiveness, driven by testosterone. The rise in sensation-seeking and competitiveness can overtake the rise in self-control, making older adolescents and 20-somethings more violent despite their blossoming frontal lobes. In the long run, self-control gains the upper hand when it is fortified by experience, which teaches adolescents that thrill-seeking and competitiveness have costs and that self-control has rewards. The arc of crime in adolescence is the outcome of these inner forces pushing and pulling in different directions. Self-control, then, is a stable trait that differentiates one person from another, beginning in early childhood. No one has done the twin and adoption studies that would be needed to show that performance on standard tests of self-control, such as the marshmallow test or the adult equivalent, are heritable. But it's a good bet that they are, because pretty much every psychological trait has turned out to be partly heritable. Self-control is partly correlated with intelligence, with a coefficient of about 0.23 on a scale from minus 1 to 1, and the two traits depend on the same parts of the human brain, though not exactly in the same way. Intelligence itself is highly correlated with crime. Duller people commit more violent crimes and are more likely to be the victims of a violent crime, and though we can't rule out the possibility that the effect of self-control is really an effect of intelligence or vice versa, it's likely that both traits contribute independently to nonviolence. Another clue that self-control is heritable is that a syndrome marked by a shortage of self-control, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is also linked with delinquency and crime, is among the most heritable of personality traits. So far, all the evidence that violence is released by a lack of self-control is correlational. It comes from the discovery that some people have less self-control than others, and that those people are likely to misbehave, get angry, and commit more crimes. But the correlation doesn't prove causation. Perhaps people with low self-control are more crime-prone because they are also less intelligent, or they come from worse environments, or they have some other across-the-board disadvantage. More important, a stable trait that differs from one person to another cannot explain the main thing we're trying to explain, why rates of violence change over the course of history. To show that, we need to show that individual people, when they let up or clamp down on their self-control, get more or less violent as a result. And we must show that people and societies can cultivate the faculty of self-control over time and thereby drive down their rates of violence. Let's see if we can find these missing links. When a person fights an urge, it feels like a strenuous effort. Many of the idioms for self-control invoke the concept of force, such as willpower, force of will, strength of will, and self-restraint. The linguist Len Talmy has noticed that the language of self-control borrows from the language of force dynamics, as if self-control were a homunculus that physically impinged on a stubborn antagonist inside the skull. We use the same construction in Sally forced the door to open and Sally forced herself to go to work, in Biff controlled his dog and Biff controlled his temper. Like many conceptual metaphors, self-control is physical effort turns out to have a kernel of neurobiological reality. In a remarkable set of experiments, Baumeister and his collaborators have shown that self-control, like a muscle, can become fatigued. Their laboratory procedure is best introduced by quoting from the methods section of one of their papers. Procedure. Participants signed up for a study on taste perception. Each participant was contacted to schedule an individual session, and at that time, the experimenter requested the participant to skip one meal before the experiment and make sure not to have eaten anything for at least 3 hours. The laboratory room was carefully set up before participants in the food conditions arrived. Chocolate chip cookies were baked in the room in a small oven, and as a result, the laboratory was filled with the delicious aroma of fresh chocolate and baking. Two foods were displayed on the table at which the participant was seated. One display consisted of a stack of chocolate chip cookies augmented by some chocolate candies. The other consisted of a bowl of red and white radishes. The cover story was that the experiment was on sensory memory and that the participants would experience one of two distinctive tastes and have to recall its qualities after a delay. The experimenter told half the participants to eat two or three of the cookies and the other half to eat two or three of the radishes. She left the room and watched through a one-way mirror to confirm that the participant did not cheat. The article notes, "Several of them did indicate clear interest in the chocolates to the point of looking longingly at the chocolate display, and in a few cases even picking up the cookies to sniff at them." The experimenter then told them they would have to wait 15 minutes for the test of their memory of the taste. In the interim, they were to solve some puzzles that required tracing a geometric figure with a pencil without either retracing a line or lifting the pencil off the paper. Compounding the sadism, the experimenters had given them puzzles that were unsolvable and measured how long the participant persisted before giving up. The ones who had eaten the cookies spent 18.9 minutes and made 34.3 attempts to solve the puzzle. The ones who had eaten the radishes spent 8.4 minutes and made 19.4 attempts. Presumably, the radish eaters had depleted so much of their mental strength in resisting the cookies that they had little left to persist in solving the puzzles. Baumeister called the effect ego depletion, using Freud's sense of ego as the mental entity that controls the passions. The study raises many objections. Maybe the radish eaters were just frustrated or angry or in a bad mood or hungry. But the Baumeister team addressed them, and over the following decade accumulated a raft of experiments showing that just about any task that requires an exercise of willpower can impede performance in any other task that requires willpower. Here are a few tasks that can deplete the ego. Name the color in which a word is displayed, such as the word red, printed in blue ink. Ignoring the color it spells out. The Stroop task. Track moving boxes on a screen as if playing a shell game, while ignoring a comedy video on an adjacent screen. Write a convincing speech on why tuition fees should be raised. Write an essay about the typical day in the life of a fat person without using any stereotypes. Watch the scene in Terms of Endearment, in which a dying Deborah Winger says goodbye to her children without showing emotion. For racially prejudiced people, carry on a conversation with an African American. Write down all your thoughts, but don't think of a polar bear. And here are some of the lapses in willpower that result. Giving up sooner when squeezing a hand grip, solving anagrams, or watching a movie of a box on a table until something happens. Breaking a diet by eating ice cream from a container after rating a spoonful in a taste experiment. Drinking more beer in a taste experiment, even when having to take a simulated driving test immediately afterward. Failing to stifle sexual thoughts, such as in solving the anagram NISEP as penis rather than as spine. Failing to keep up a running conversation while teaching someone how to putt in golf. Being willing to pay more for an attractive watch, car, or boat. Blowing your payment for participation in the study on gum, candy, Doritos, or playing cards, which the experimenters had mischievously offered for sale. Various control conditions allowed the psychologists to rule out alternative explanations such as fatigue, difficulty, mood, and lack of confidence. The only common denominator was the need for self-control. An important implication of the research is that the exercise of self-control can conceal the differences among individual people. It's no coincidence that 1960s popular culture, which denigrated sobriety and self-control, also denigrated conformity, as in the signature motto, "Do your own thing." Everyone has a different thing, but society insists on just one thing, so we must apply self-control to do it. If self-control flattens individuality, one can predict that when the ego is depleted, individuality will pop back up. And that is what the Baumeister group found. In the ice cream tasting experiment, when the participants had not been called on to exercise self-control beforehand, the dieters and the indiscriminate eaters consumed the same amount of ice cream. But when their willpower had been exhausted, the dieters ate more. Other individual differences unmasked by depletion of the ego included the degree of stereotyping by prejudiced and unprejudiced people, the amount of beer drunk by tipplers and moderate drinkers, and the amount of small talk made by shy and outgoing people. The Baumeister group also vindicated the Victorian idea that some people, particularly men, have to exert their will to control their sexual appetites. In one study, the psychologists assessed how emotionally close a participant had to feel to another person before engaging in casual sex. People of both sexes differ along that dimension, and there is also a robust difference between the sexes, captured in the movie dialogue in which Diane Keaton says, "I believe that sex without love is a meaningless experience." And Woody Allen replies, "Yes, but as meaningless experiences go, it's one of the best." Half the participants in the study went through an ego depletion task, crossing out letters according to shifting rules, and all were then asked to imagine themselves being in a committed romantic relationship, and then finding themselves in the hotel room of an attractive acquaintance of the opposite sex. They were then asked whether they imagined themselves succumbing to the temptation. Whether their wills had been tuckered or not, the participants of both sexes, who had indicated that sex without love was a meaningless experience, imagined they would resist the temptation. But a transient weakness of their will affected the ones who were more open to casual sex. If their ego had just been fatigued, their imagined selves were far more likely to say yes. The pattern for the two sexes was revealing. When the willpower of the participants was fresh, men and women didn't differ. Both were resistant to imaginary cheating. When their wills had been weakened, the women were just as resistant, but the men imagined themselves likely to stray. Another sign that gallantry requires self-control came from an analysis that simply compared people who reported having a lot or a little self-control, ignoring momentary ego depletion. Among those with high self-control, neither the men nor the women imagined cheating on their partners, but among the people with low self-control, the men imagined that they probably would. The pattern suggests that the exercise of self-control hides a deep difference between men and women. Freed from their own willpower, men are more likely to act as evolutionary psychology predicts. Baumeister and Guyot pushed their luck in one more experiment, aiming to show that self-control affects real, not just imagined, sexual activity. They invited couples into the lab who were either sexually experienced or just beginning their relationship, separated them, gave them an ego depletion task, concentrating on a boring video while shutting out distractions, reunited them, and invited them to be affectionate with each other for 3 minutes while the experimenter discreetly left the room. A sense of propriety prevented the experimenters from videotaping the couple or observing them from behind a one-way mirror, so they asked each partner to write a confidential paragraph describing exactly what had gone on between them. Experienced couples, if their wills had been depleted, were a bit less physical, as if sex had switched from a passion to a chore. But ego depletion made the inexperienced couples far more physical. According to the write-up, they kissed open-mouthed for prolonged periods of time, groped and caressed each other, e.g. on the buttocks and woman's chest, and even removed articles of clothing to expose themselves. According to the theory of the civilizing process, a dearth of self-control in medieval Europe underlay many forms of dissoluteness, including slovenliness, petulance, licentiousness, uncouthness, steep discounting of the future, and most important, violence. The science of self-control vindicates the idea that a single capability of mind can counteract many of these forms of dissipation, but it remains to be shown that violence is one of them. We know that people with less self-control are more cantankerous and trouble-prone, but can manipulating self-control in an experiment bring out the beast within? No one wants a fight to break out in the lab, so Baumeister went to the hot sauce. Hungry participants were asked to take part in a study on the relation between tastes in food and written expression. They indicated their favorite and least favorite flavors, wrote an essay expressing their views on abortion, rated the essay of a bogus fellow participant, rated the taste of a food, and finally read their partner's feedback on their essay. In the taste test, half of them had to rate the taste, texture, and aroma of a donut, half had to rate the taste, texture, and aroma of a radish. But just as they raised the stimulus to their mouth, the experimenter exclaimed, "Wait, I'm sorry. I think I screwed up. This isn't for you. Please don't eat the rest of it. Let me go figure out what's supposed to be next." He then left the participants alone with the donut or the radish for 5 minutes. Lest there be any doubt that this was a valid test of self-control, one may note the following passage in the write-up. Participants: 40 undergraduates participated in this study in exchange for course credit. Data from 7 participants were discarded from all analyses, 4 due to expressed suspicion about the feedback, and 3 due to participants having eaten the entire donut. The participants then read the partner's feedback on their essay, which was scathing. They also were shown his or her taste preferences, which indicated a dislike of spicy foods. And then they were asked to prepare a snack for the partner from a bag of chips and a container of hot sauce prominently labeled spicy. The amount they applied was measured by weighing the container after they left. The participants were also asked to rate their moods, including anger. The ones whose self-control had been depleted by having to forego the donut didn't get mad, but they did get even. They applied 62% more hot sauce to the chip of their insulting partner, presumably because they could not resist the impulse for revenge. Will-depleted subjects were also more likely to torment a critic by leaning on a button to blast him with an air horn every time he made an error in a computer game. Another study tapped aggressive fantasies by asking participants to imagine standing at a bar with a beloved girlfriend when a rival shows up and begins to flirt to her visible enjoyment. In the scenario given to women, it was a boyfriend who was chatted up by a rival woman. The participant imagines confronting the rival, who responds by shoving him into the bar. Close at hand is a beer bottle. The participant was asked, "How likely would you be to smash the bottle on the person's head? Indicate your response on a scale from minus 100, not at all likely, to 100, extremely likely." The participants who were low in self-control, if their wills were ready and rested, indicated they probably would not retaliate. But if their wills had been depleted, they indicated they probably would. If we combine one, Baumeister's experiments, which found that reducing self-control in the lab can increase tendencies toward impulsive sex and violence, two, the correlations across individuals between low self-control on the one hand and childhood misconduct, dissolute behavior, and crime on the other, three, the neuroimaging studies that showed correlations between frontal lobe activity and self-control, and four, the neuroimaging studies showing correlations between impulsive violence and impaired frontal lobe function, then we get an empirical picture that supports Elias's conjecture that violence may be caused by weakness in an overarching neural mechanism of self-control. The picture is still incomplete. The existence of a trait that is stable in an individual over a span of decades and that can be depleted over a span of minutes cannot explain how a society can change over a span of centuries. We still need to show that whatever level of self-control a person is born with, he or she has ways to boost it. There is no paradox in the possibility that self-control can both be heritable across individuals and rise over time. That is exactly what happened with stature. Genes make some of us taller than others, but over the centuries, everyone got taller. For as long as people have reflected on self-control, they have reflected on ways to enhance it. Odysseus had his sailors tie him to the mast and plug their ears with wax so he could hear the alluring song of the sirens without steering his ship onto the rocks. Techniques in which the present self handicaps the future self are sometimes called Odyssean or Ulyssean in his honor. There are hundreds of examples. We avoid shopping on an empty stomach. We throw out the brownies or the cigarettes or the booze at a time when we aren't craving them to foil ourselves at a time when we are. We put our alarm clock on the other side of the bedroom so we don't turn it off and fall back asleep. We authorize our employers to invest a part of every paycheck for our retirement. We refrain from buying a magazine or a book or a gadget that will divert our attention from a work project until it is complete. We hand over money to a company like Stick.com that returns it a fraction at a time if we meet certain goals, or donates it to a political organization we detest if we don't. We make a public resolution to change, so our reputation takes a hit if we don't. As we saw in Chapter 3, one way the early modern Europeans used Odyssean self-control was to keep sharp knives out of reach at the dinner table. The familiar sign in the saloons in old westerns, "Check your guns at the door," served the same purpose, as do gun control laws and disarmament agreements today. Another tactic is to keep oneself away from trouble, such as avoiding the place where an aggrieved rival is known to hang out. Brawlers who allow themselves to be pulled apart by bystanders avail themselves of a similar tactic, with the added bonus that they have not conceded weakness or cowardice by disengaging. Other strategies of self-control are mental rather than physical. Walter Mischel showed that even four-year-olds can wait out a long interval for a double helping of marshmallows if they cover the alluring marshmallow in front of them, look away from it, distract themselves by singing, or even reframe it in their minds as a puffy white cloud rather than a sweet, tasty food. An equivalent in the case of violence may be the cognitive reframing of an insult from a devastating blow to one's reputation to an ineffectual gesture or a reflection on the immaturity of the insulter. Such reframing lies behind advice like, don't take it personally, dismissals like, he's just blowing smoke, he's only a kid, and take it from whom it comes, and proverbs like, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, invoking the economist's theory of optimal interest rates and the biologist's theory of optimal foraging, have suggested a third way in which self-control can be manipulated. They propose that organisms are equipped with an internal variable, like an adjustable interest rate, that governs how steeply they discount the future. The setting of the variable is twiddled according to the stability or instability of their environment, and an estimate of how long they will live. It doesn't pay to save for tomorrow, if tomorrow will never come, or if your world is so chaotic that you have no confidence you would get your savings back. In a quantitative comparison of neighborhoods in a major city, Daly and Wilson found that the shorter the expected lifespan, from all causes other than violence, the higher the rate of violent crime. The correlation supports the hypothesis that, holding age constant, people are more reckless when they have fewer years of unlived life at risk. A rational adjustment of one's discounting rate in response to the uncertainty of the environment could create a vicious circle, since your own recklessness then figures into the discounting rate of everyone else. The Matthew effect, in which everything seems to go right in some societies and wrong in others, could be a consequence of environmental uncertainty and psychological recklessness feeding on each other. A fourth way people in a society might boost their self-control is by improving their nutrition, sobriety, and health. The frontal lobe is a big slab of metabolically demanding tissue with an outsized appetite for glucose and other nutrients. Pushing the metaphor of self-control as physical effort even further, Baumaster found that people's blood glucose level plummets as their ego is depleted by an attention-consuming or willpower-demanding task. And if they replenish their glucose level by drinking a glass of sugar-sweetened lemonade, but not a glass of aspartame-sweetened lemonade, they avoid the usual slump in the follow-up task. It is not implausible to suppose that real-world conditions that impair the frontal lobes, low blood sugar, drunkenness, druggedness, parasite load, and deficiencies of vitamins and minerals, could sap the self-control of people in an impoverished society and leave them more prone to impulsive violence. Several placebo-controlled studies have suggested that providing prisoners with dietary supplements can reduce their rate of impulsive violence. Baumeister stretched the metaphor even farther. If willpower is like a muscle that fatigues with use, drains the body of energy, and can be revived by a sugary pick-me-up, can it also be bulked up by exercise? Can people develop their raw strength of will by repeatedly flexing their determination and resolve? The metaphor shouldn't be taken too literally. It's unlikely that the frontal lobes literally gain tissue like bulging biceps, but it's possible that the neural connections between the cortex and limbic system may be strengthened with practice. It's also possible that people can learn strategies of self-control, enjoy the feeling of mastery over their impulses, and transfer their newfound tricks of discipline from one part of their behavioral repertoire to another. Baumeister and other psychologists tested the exercise metaphor by having participants undertake regimens of self-control for several weeks or months before taking part in one of their ego depletion studies. In various studies, the regimens required them to keep track of every piece of food they ate, enroll in programs of physical exercise, money management, or study skills, use their non-preferred hand for everyday tasks like brushing their teeth and using a computer mouse, and one that really gave the student self-control a workout, avoid curse words, speak in complete sentences, and not begin sentences with I. After several weeks of this cross-training, the students indeed turned out to be more resistant to ego depletion tasks in the lab, and they also showed greater self-control in their lives. They smoked fewer cigarettes, drank less alcohol, ate less junk food, spent less money, watched less television, studied more, and washed the dishes more often rather than leaving them in the sink. Score another point for Elias's conjecture that self-control in life's little routines can become second nature and be generalized to the rest of one's comportment. In addition to being modulated by Ulyssian constraints, cognitive reframing, an adjustable internal discount rate, improvements in nutrition, and the equivalent of muscle gain with exercise, self-control might be at the mercy of whims and fashion. In some eras, self-control defines the paragon of a decent person, a grown-up, a person of dignity, a lady or a gentleman, a mensch. In others, it is jeered at as uptight, prudish, stuffy, straight-laced, puritanical. Certainly, the crime-prone 1960s were the recent era that most glorified the relaxation of self-control. Do your own thing. Let it all hang out. If it feels good, do it. Take a walk on the wild side. The premium on self-indulgence is on full display in concert films from the decade, which show rock musicians working so hard to outdo each other in impulsiveness that it looks as if they put a lot of planning and effort into their spontaneity. Could these six pathways to self-control proliferate among the members of a society and come to define its global character? That would be the final domino in the chain of explanation that makes up the theory of the civilizing process. The exogenous first domino is a change in law enforcement and opportunities for economic cooperation that objectively tilt the payoffs so that a deferral of gratification, in particular an avoidance of impulsive violence, pays off in the long run. The knock-on effect is a strengthening of people's self-control muscles that allow them, among other things, to inhibit their violent impulses above and beyond what is strictly necessary to avoid being caught and punished. The process could even feed on itself in a positive feedback loop, positive in both the engineering and the human values sense. In a society in which other people control their aggression, a person has less of a need to cultivate a hair trigger for retaliation, which in turn takes a bit of pressure off everyone else, and so on. One way to bridge the gap between psychology and history is to look for changes in a society-wide index of self-control. As we have seen, an interest rate is just such an index, because it reveals how much compensation people demand for deferring consumption from the present to the future. To be sure, an interest rate is partly determined by objective factors like inflation, expected income growth, and the risk that the investment will never be returned. But it partly reflects the purely psychological preference for instant over delayed gratification. According to one economist, a six-year-old who prefers to eat one marshmallow now rather than two marshmallows a few minutes from now is, in effect, demanding an interest rate of 3% a day, or 150% a month. Gregory Clark, the economic historian we met in Chapter 4, has estimated the interest rates that Englishmen demand in the form of rents on land and houses, from 1170 to 2000, the millennium over which the civilizing process took place. Before 1800, he argues, there was no inflation to speak of. Incomes were flat, and the risk that an owner would lose his property was low and constant. If so, the effective interest rate was an estimate of the degree to which people favored their present selves over their future selves. During the centuries in which homicide plummeted in England, the effective interest rate also plummeted, from more than 10% to around 2%. Other European societies showed a similar transition. The correlation does not, of course, prove causation, but it is consistent with Elias's claim that the decline of violence from medieval to modern Europe was part of a broader trend toward self-control and an orientation to the future. What about more direct measures of a society's aggregate self-control? An annual interest rate is still quite distant from the momentary exercises of forbearance that suppress violent impulses in everyday life. Though there are dangers in essentializing a society by assigning it character traits that really should apply to individuals, remember the so-called fierce people, there may be a grain of truth in the impression that some cultures are marked by more self-control in everyday life than others. Friedrich Nietzsche distinguished between Apollonian and Dionysian cultures, named after the Greek gods of light and wine, and the distinction was used by the anthropologist Ruth Benedict in her classic 1934